Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where each week we remind you that freedom is not free by introducing you to some of the men and women who paid that price. And in the nearly two decades I've had the privilege of interviewing World War II veterans, I've had the chance to meet many others around our country contributing quality work in a like-minded pursuit, capturing that history so it can be communicated to younger and future generations as well. The new film Unbroken Honor represents another sterling example of that phenomenon, introducing new audiences to the incredible service and sacrifice of Americans of Japanese ancestry during World War II. And one thing I really appreciate about this documentary is that it chronicles not only the often-told heroics of the go-for-broke soldiers of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, but also the much less publicized contributions of those who served with the Military Intelligence Service, kept classified for decades, with many of the veterans' families having no idea what kind of impact they had on the Allied victory in World War II.
My father's response was, "Oh, didn't I ever tell you about that? I thought I told you that a long time ago." And I said, "No."
What Harold Fudena didn't share with his son for years is today considered a major turning point in the war in the Pacific. In April of 1943, the 5th Air Force requested Nisei MIS units to join the 138th Signal Radio Intercept Company at Seven Mile Strip on New Guinea. Not long after, Sergeant Fudena was on island, monitoring Japanese tactical frequencies on specialized radio equipment. On April 13th, Army and Navy intercept stations in Hawaii and the West Coast picked up Japanese chatter indicating that a high-level inspection of South Pacific forces would be happening soon and would be overseen by the commander of the Japanese Combined Fleet Command, Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto. Yamamoto was the architect and chief planner of the Pearl Harbor attack and one of Japan's greatest military minds.
The story of Admiral Yamamoto's fate and the code-breaking work that led to it is another element of World War II that we've explored on Hometown Heroes over the years with men who participated, and it is told very well in Unbroken Honor. The voice you heard at the end there is that of the filmmaker Jeff Aiello, who gathered supporters to get a first look at Unbroken Honor this past week in California's San Joaquin Valley, where so many Americans of Japanese ancestry were forced out of their homes and into camps 80 years ago. Among the crowd for that film premiere, World War II veterans Clarence Suzuki and Robert Uesaka. You got to premiere this film in front of a very special group of people that included two Nisei veterans of World War II, two Nisei veterans who we've heard here on Hometown Heroes. Were you a little nervous about them being in the room while you showed this hour that you've been working on for 3 years?
I was nervous whether they were there or not. it's the most nerve-wracking thing, and I said this to the group at Roger Rocca's when we premiered it last week. One of the most nerve-wracking things as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, an artist, whatever you want to call yourself, is revealing your creation to everyone besides your wife who's watched it be made and who helped it make it. It's very nerve-wracking. It's like, oh man, I really like this film. And a lot of my projects that I do, I'm not 100% in love with them, but they got to go. They have to go on the air. They got to get out. This one, I really loved when it was done. I loved it. I felt really satisfied, but I was really nervous to show it to everybody. And that's normal. To have Robert and Clarence there was an honor. I recognized them both. And I felt pretty good that they would feel like we did them proud, especially Clarence, who served in the Military Intelligence Service. You know, the 442 sort of gets all the spotlight from the Nisei soldier story point. And, you know, the Military Intelligence Service wasn't even really known to exist in the public until Nixon signed an executive order that declassified all of the World War II documents. And that's when its existence sort of became known. And so, you know, I was really glad that we could shine a light. It's kind of equal time. The MIS story we have is fantastic because I found the son of Harold Fudena, Sergeant Harold Fudena, who served in the Military Intelligence Service and was the guy who broke the code that revealed where Admiral Yamamoto was going to be on Bougainville in the Solomon Islands at a specific time. Yamamoto was notorious for being punctual, which was sort of his undoing, because the entire Operation Vengeance that was greenlit by Nimitz could and was built around the belief that when Yamamoto said he was going to land at Balalay Airfield at 9:30 in the morning, our guys could bet that that was going to happen and plan that crazy mission with those P-38 Lightnings that flew 400 miles over the ocean, over the Coral Sea, 50 feet, max elevation, max altitude, zero radio. You know, it's just a crazy story. So being able to tell all that, it was fun. Clarence, serving in the Military Intelligence Service, I know I got to speak with him a little bit after the film, and they were both, they gave me that look. They might not be big on words, but I got the look from both of them. And I remember Robert specifically, his look. I got the nod and the look, so I felt good about that.
Again, that's filmmaker Jeff Aiello talking about Robert Uwasaka, a veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, and Clarence Suzuki, who served in the MIS. Both of those veterans have shared their unique experiences on Hometown Heroes before, and you can find their episodes at hometownheroesradio.com, as well as a two-episode conversation years ago with Lawson Sakai, who is featured so significantly in this new documentary, Unbroken Honor. His is a story I know I'll never get tired of hearing, and I hope you get a feel for the before and after of life interrupted, of just how jarring and transformational this chapter of our history is.
We were actually 7 miles from downtown Los Angeles City Hall. I walked it one time, and there was a lot of open land between where we were and downtown LA, not like it is today. But we had 5 acres, which, you know, it was a small greenhouse type flower industry, but it was in a nice location and easy to get to market. So my summers were spent on the farm. Growing up through the Depression years, of course, everybody had to do something because, you know, it was tough going in the late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah, what do you remember about those times? And what about your family? Did you have brothers and sisters?
I had one older sister. We really were a very small family. Most of the families, Japanese families, had 5, 6, 7, 8 children. They had big families, and their farm a little bigger. But in our case, we were very small, and I think it was sufficient. I used to help my father whatever I could. I was going to school, so I couldn't help him very much. But the whole Japanese community, and they used to get together for their own parties, but they couldn't associate with anybody else. Number one, they didn't speak the language, and number two, the other people didn't want the Japanese to mingle with them. But they were becoming the best and biggest farmers, best and biggest flower growers, the best and biggest fishermen. They had a huge fishing fleet at Terminal Island. My uncle was driving a Chrysler Airflow around, which was the car in, you know, 1938-9.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of business jealousies and so forth, and a lot of pressure on the politicians to remove the Japanese, which was the talk, was send them to Japan, you know, after Pearl Harbor, you know, ship them all to Japan, whether they're American citizens or not. That, you know, so, and they possibly could have if they wanted to, I'm sure. You know, they put 120,000 into camps.
Yeah.
It wouldn't take much more to start putting them on ships and sending them out. So that was kind of the rumor going around. But
even before Pearl Harbor, I'm interested in your experience, because clearly that was a differentiating point. But I understand you were a pretty good athlete. You played high school football and basketball, even some in junior college?
It was war years. I weighed 140 pounds.
Yeah.
I played a running guard at Compton Junior College. I graduated high school in 1941. Mm-hmm. So in September, I went to Compton Junior College, and the ranks were depleted, let's say. So I got to play second string football. Mm-hmm. And I also played baseball later before I left California. But
had you ever faced any kind of discrimination in school? being Japanese American?
Very little. Nothing really to speak of, because the teachers were good. Almost all of my friends, the students, were all good. When I went, of course, I knew almost everybody at Montebello High School. When I went to Compton, I knew maybe one other person, maybe two. I didn't know anybody else. They're all strangers, but we all got along fine. Mm-hmm. Really had a good time there. The coach, Ed Suggett, used to kid me a lot. He said, when Japan attacks California, he says, are you going to attack me?
But I imagine that December 7th really changed your life. That's probably a pretty memorable day.
It didn't affect me as a student. The other students didn't say, what the hell's going on or anything. They, you know, it just, I don't think it affected them as students, and they never passed it on to me. I got along fine before and after Pearl Harbor. The only thing, of course, the newspapers, radio, and so forth, it's really gearing up for getting worse and worse every day.
And that day, specifically for you, December 7th, 1941, I like to ask every veteran this, Japanese American or otherwise, because they all seem to remember something. And do you remember that moment when you found out?
It was Sunday morning. I was doing homework. I was listening to my radio when the announcer broke in and said Pearl Harbor had been attacked. I didn't pay much attention to it because I really didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. Then as the news report kept coming on, it was like they would break in every 15 minutes or so and give you more information. Then, you know, it described how the battleships were being sunk and so forth. It was a pretty big deal. And then I realized how serious it really was. So it was kind of tough talking to my parents. They were working when they came in for lunch. You know, it was kind of, I broke the news to them, and they were pretty shocked. They knew it was going to happen. Everything was pointing toward some kind of a confrontation. So I don't think they were surprised, but they were pretty disappointed that it did happen, because then now it's what's going to happen to us. You know, that was the thing. And then, of course, that afternoon, the FBI shows up, and, you know, they take my uncle away. So,
and I want everyone to hear that, because I don't think people realize, especially people that weren't alive, this is really hard for them to fathom. The very day that Pearl Harbor happens, the FBI shows up and takes your uncle.
They took a lot of people on December 7th. They knew where everybody was.
And why do you feel that your uncle was targeted, that he was snatched
up? He was the leader of the United Farmers Association, UFA, the largest produce market, 9th Street Market in L.A., a big wheeler dealer. So, you know, when they take the head, that leaves the rest of the body lifeless. Mm-hmm. And that's what they were doing. They were picking up whoever, teachers, lawyers, doctors, businessmen, anybody that they considered a leader of the community. They hauled them away, and that usually left people underneath who really were kind of helpless, and families, in most cases, the men in those days did everything. Mm-hmm. The mother just raised the family and helpless. Mm-hmm. This is what happened. All this kind of crippled the Japanese families. So it made it easy for the U.S. government to take the next step, which was putting everybody into the American concentration camps that were being built at the same time.
It's time for our final break, but we'll hear more of Lawson Sakai's journey and more about this new film that tells his story and the collective story of our Nisei veterans. Again, it's Unbroken Honor. You can find it online right now, and Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.